Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Well, we have another, as usual, we have another question. This one is from Amanda. For those of you that are new to the podcast, we pretty much, for the most part, talk about perimenopause, menopause, and hormone replacement therapy. If you go to our website, progresshealth.com, you're interested in submitting a question for us to discuss, click the Ask the Doctor tab, which is at the top of the website. Enter your name and email and submit your question there. And we are collecting a lot of questions, but they're very good. They're very detailed. So we're excited for the, for the opportunity to be able to, provide some value and get some answers for people. So Dr. Davidson, why don't you go ahead and read the question from Amanda?
Okay. So question. Hello, I'm 50 years old and had a hysterectomy sparing the ovaries at age 40. Been on oral microprogesterone and love it. However, over the last few years, the hot flashes have started and the supplements helped for a while, and then had about a 7-pound increase over the last 18 months and my small frame felt it. Then, out of the blue, 3 months ago, I started having PVC palpitations with no chest pain, no dizziness, just annoying and not comfortable. I am super fit and eat very clean. My Dutch test showed estrogen just over 1 and showing postmenopausal. My functional gynecologist started me on biased 80-20 ratio about 3 weeks ago. I do 4 pumps in the morning on my thighs. Not sure if I should be rotating thighs, but throughout the day, the palpitations felt a little better within the first week, then came back. And I do the cream and then they go away and now they start back up again at 1 p.m. and then last throughout the rest of the day into the evening. Occasionally, the palpitations will wait until 5 or 6 p.m. to start again. I have my follow-up in June, and I don't want to wait and see if 2 times a day is better for me. So I have 2 questions. Am I metabolizing through it, or should I split 2 pumps in the morning and 2 pumps in the evening when the palpitations start again? Will that backslide any progress I've made? Should I rotate thighs every day? Thank you for any help.
So there's lots of questions going on there, right? She had like 5 questions at the end there.
2 questions.
But this is honestly, this is a very important one, right? Because nobody wants anything happening with their heart. Okay? It's a very scary thing when your heart, especially at 50 years old, the 50 nowadays, 50 is like the new 30, right? I mean, it's not any, we've talked about this many times, the transition or the progress in health span that people have made over the last, 20, 30 years is pretty incredible. She says she's super fit, so I'm assuming she's exercising on a regular basis. We'll come back to that in a minute in relationship to the palpitations. There's a lot to break down here from even all the way back to her hysterectomy at 40. I'd love to know why she had the hysterectomy at 40, all the way up to the palpitations. She's noticing that there's some improvement when she applies the cream. So what jumps out to you first in this question?
Well, one of the classic menopausal symptoms is having palpitations. I don't know if they're, she says they're PVCs, but there's lots of different types of palpitations. But when you're going through menopause, so, Amanda has her ovaries. So she had that hysterectomy, the uterus removed. She has her ovaries and they were probably still pumping out those hormones up until here she is 50 years old. Is classic is when that estrogen drops, it's like your heart feels like it's doing little somersaults or little flip-flops. That's like a classic symptom. So, but of course, like you said, nobody, at 50 years old is, they're afraid if something's going on with their heart. But I really think, for Amanda, it really has to do with probably the estrogen dose that she's on.
Yeah, because she does notice, she does mention that there is improvement to the palpitations when she applies the cream, and then the, the cream sort of quote unquote wears off, and the palpitations come back. So she, at least she's noticed or observed that kind of correlation between the two. And like you said, Palpitations. Now, there's probably three main types of palpitations to be sort of aware of. There's what are called PVCs, premature ventricular contractions. So those are palpitations that originate from the left ventricle. Okay, that's not really perfect or ideal. We don't want arrhythmias to be arising from the left ventricle. That's the important part of the heart that pumps out all the blood to your body. The less, maybe more common, PVCs are still very common. Cardiologists don't get too worried about them. They're not technically dangerous. Caffeine will make them worse for sure. So if you're drinking coffee, she's exercising, very fit. When she says very fit, to me, that translates into lots of exercise. So over the years, you and I sort of look at, in this context, for a 50-year-old woman, we look at palpitations. So PVCs is one, AFib is the other type, and another one is called SVT, supraventricular tachycardia. Okay, so AFib and SVT are arrhythmias that are outside of the ventricles, which is a key distinction. Those are, in some ways, non-life-threatening arrhythmias. Those are pretty much kind of harmless. Okay, but like I said, nobody wants anything to be happening with their heart, so it makes everybody nervous. But, you know, to what you said, this is a very, very common, we've been doing this for a long time, it's a very common symptom of low estrogen for a woman to be experiencing. They go to the cardiologist, she knows they're PVCs, so that means she's probably had a Holter monitor on for a little while. Cardiologist put her on one of those devices, tracked her rhythm for, you know, 7 days, 2 weeks, a month, to be able to determine that she's having these PVCs. What do you think about the four pumps in the morning versus doing it twice a day? She's asking a bunch of questions there about the dosing.
Yeah, and these are great questions. They come up for so many people. I do feel like, so she says four pumps. A lot of times Biest is a combination hormone cream. It's bioidentical. It has estriol in it, E3, and estradiol, E2 combined. That's why they call it Biest. When it says 80-20, that means that there's 80% estriol to 20% estradiol, and it comes as a cream. So when she says pumps, it's probably, they usually come in little toppy click containers or different containers, and you just either click it or press this little button. Usually four pumps, four clicks equals 1 milligram. So she's putting on, not 1 milligram,
One milliliter.
Yeah, 1 milliliter. So when she's putting that on, she says the 80-20 on here, but we don't really know what the dose is. So I have a feeling the dose is pretty low, that when she puts it on in the morning, by the time the afternoon comes around, it's already out of her system. And to be honest, you know, Biest is a really nice form of, you know, hormone replacement, but it doesn't have a lot of longevity in the body. Which is why when I do Biest with patients and with clients, I have them do it twice a day, because let's say she's putting it on at 7 a.m, by 7 o'clock at night, midnight, it's pretty much gone out of her system. So I do think she should probably do it twice a day, but when she's saying, so she's asking if she should split it up, do two pumps in the morning or two pumps in the evening. If she's putting on four pumps in the morning and she's still getting those, her symptoms, hot flashes, palpitations by 1 p.m, if she does two pumps, she's probably going to start feeling symptoms probably an hour or two after she applies it. So if anything, I definitely think she should be using a Biest twice a day, as most women that are doing hormone replacement, if they're using Biest, but probably needs to increase up that dosage.
Yeah. See, this is one thing that we see quite often when people, when everyone is submitting questions about their Biest cream or whatever type of estrogen therapy they're using, they never give us, they give us the ratio, 80-20, 50-50, 70-30, whatever the ratio is, but they fail to give us the milligram amount. The ratio really doesn't mean that much. The milligrams is what matters. Because this comes down to really,
I think the ratio means,
well, it certainly matters. I mean, let's not split hairs here, right? The ratio does matter. But if we're talking less than a 1 milligram dosage at 80-20, the 80-20 means nothing at such a low dose. Right now, she's already sort of noticed that she feels she has less palpitations when she applies the cream. To your point, the cream wears off, the palpitations come back. So it's not even a matter of really of applying it twice a day. It's really the dose just needs to go up. Now, you mentioned our default when we start a woman or we're just adjusting or, you know, initiating a prescription, our default is always two pumps twice a day or two clicks twice a day. right? So 2 clicks in the morning, 2 clicks in the evening. However, that's just a starting point, and that gives us a certain amount of milligrams per application. That's why with this one, we're sort of flying blind a little bit because she doesn't give us that milligram amount.
But, you know, she does give us all, you know, a lot of information here. I would say if anybody, if you're going to submit a question and you're, because sometimes when you get your prescription, a lot of people don't know what their dose is. And then they look at their prescription and has all these letters and numbers and, you know, it's like a foreign language. So if you're not really sure what your dose is, you can always write in your question, just write all the letters and numbers you see on your, on that, you know, on the biased, you know, a TopiClick container, and I'll be able to figure it out. So, but I can understand why a lot of people probably don't put their dose in there because it's really hard to understand when you're looking at your prescription.
Yeah, because some, you know, of course, every prescription label has to have what's in there on the label. So it'll say like E2/E3 with a couple of numbers and some decimals, and it'll have all these things on there that you're right. If you don't know what it is, it makes no sense. Okay, but the, like I said, the ratio, it does matter, certainly, but in a case like this, especially the fact that she's noticed an improvement, the dosage absolutely matters. You know, so if you provide that milligram amount, because that's at the end of the day, most of the time with hormone replacement, it comes down to the actual dosing. How many milligrams per day are you applying?
And we know that she's menopausal because she did the Dutch test, which is a urine test checking for hormones, and it said that she was postmenopausal. She is 50. She is having hot flashes. She's having the palpitations. She's pretty classic right in menopause. And even though it says postmenopause here, a lot of people kind of get some of this, you know, they think, oh, I'm in menopause. It's like you crossed a line in the sand and all of a sudden you go from not being in menopause to menopause. It really is a phase, just like puberty. You know, puberty is a phase of a few years there for a teenager or a young young person. Same with menopause, it's a phase, but definitely, you know, Amanda is in menopause. I love that she's on the progesterone, the micronized progesterone, so that's really great, but I do think, you know, with the bias, we probably just need to raise up the dose. I like the Dutch test, but a lot of times when we're treating a patient or a client and we have them on hormones, sometimes the Dutch test can be a little bit sensitive, and it's and it'll pick up that estrogen replacement that they're doing, and I don't really get a really good view of if we need to increase it or decrease it because I love the objective data. So I would say maybe with Amanda is going ahead and just raising up her dosage, which would help with those palpitations. It would help with the hot flashes. It would probably also help with the 7-pound increase that she said that she's had. But then at the same time, maybe even doing a blood test to check.
Yeah, it certainly can be helpful to do a Dutch test and blood work to sort of go back and forth and see what, you know, compare those numbers, you know. So, I mean, our sort of forte or what we're used to doing is almost exclusively blood work, yeah. As opposed to saliva or urine. You
know. Well, I used to do a lot of saliva like 20 years ago, but I did a lot of blood too. So sometimes I would go back and forth, but I definitely, just because we've been doing it for so long, you know, pretty cued into that, doing the blood work.
Yeah, sure. And when you are using hormone replacement or even thyroid for that matter, right, you're taking a medication or a prescription. You want to see the impact of that prescription on whatever type of lab testing that you're doing, whether it's saliva, urine, or blood. Now, maybe, you know, I know there's, I think someone, one of the lab companies did like a comparison between the three. You and I have just sort of, you know, sort of just for the most part relied on blood work, you know, at least for the last, what, you know, at least 15 years, maybe, if anything. And so maybe that's where we feel comfortable, especially this is, again, back to dosing, doing blood work. If her dose, let's say, you know, we've seen lots of questions like hers where they don't put in the milligram amount. She's having, you know, these PVC issues, some hot flashes. Hot flashes are always an indicator of having low estrogen, right? That's one of those, you know, every woman knows that that's one of those classic menopausal symptoms. The palpitations, whether they're the three types that I mentioned, SVT, supraventricular tachycardia, AFib, which is the most common arrhythmia, and of course the PVCs, though that is also a, even though it's a cardiology, you know, a heart related problem, it is also, as I said earlier, it is a low estrogen symptom. How do we know that? Well, we've been seeing a lot of women in this exact situation over the years, And the minute they go to the cardiologist, they get a stress test, they get all the workups, the echocardiogram, EKG, the whole nine yards. And the cardiologist comes back and says, your heart's fine.
Thank goodness.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you have to get it. I mean, when your heart's doing things, you have to get that evaluated. You have to go get it checked out just to make sure there isn't something, you know, wrong there. But when you've been checked out, you know, as I mentioned, she does say that she's super fit. Okay, so I started to say this earlier and I got sidetracked on the arrhythmias. I've looked at or have approached arrhythmias as being kind of an adrenal problem. Okay, so kind of a cortisol, you know, whatever you want to say, an adrenal issue that puts, because palpitations by themselves is an electrical problem, right? So your heart runs on electricity that initiates the heartbeat every few seconds. So if you're super fit and your cortisol is being, you know, kind of your cortisol demands really high, depending on what that fitness level is, it can kind of put a little extra burden on the heart cells. There's some very specific cells that control heart rhythm and that can contribute to that. So it's a combination of, an adrenal cortisol issue and a lack of estrogen. And now you're having all these PVCs on a consistent basis, which of course for anyone is really scary.
And then also too, another classic menopausal symptom is the 7 pounds. You know, you hit 50, it's like, yeah, 7 pounds, 10 pounds just like comes on overnight. She said it happened slowly over the last 18 months, but she's little. So an extra 7 pounds, she's probably definitely noticing that. So she's got a lot of classic symptoms here having to do with that, with menopause, with the lower estrogen. She doesn't say how much progesterone she's on. I'd love to know that. I have a feeling it's probably 100 milligrams. That's pretty much a typical like dose of progesterone when you're going to prescribe that. So she's probably on that. But it's, and then she also mentions here too about if she should rotate her applying her hormone cream. So one thing that is interesting is that she is putting it on the inner thigh, which I do like. I think the inner thigh is a good place to apply your hormone cream. It's a nice, got a little fatty pad there because hormones are all fat soluble. So it can, and then also for females, our inner thighs is soft skin, so it can penetrate in there. And if you're putting it on the inner thigh, as opposed to putting it, say, on your forearms, you're not sharing it with anybody. When you put hormones on your forearms, you can share it with the animals, with babies, if you give someone a hug, So a lot of times, now granted, for women, it's probably not as big a deal as it is for men. So when men are applying testosterone cream, they do a lot of testosterone. A man would never want to put it on their arms because it's so easy to transfer it to other people and to animals. But I would say, honestly, for Amanda, her question about if she should rotate, I would just keep it to the thigh. You can do one thigh in the morning, the other thigh in the evening. I don't think you're not going to have any dermal adaptation because, like I mentioned, that skin is pretty thin there. You're going to have a nice absorbency that I wouldn't say that she would need to rotate it at all.
Yeah. The other thing about applying it to the forearms or even upper arm, is that, and we've seen this many, many times. I just had a case recently where there is some cream applied to the upper arms and it skews blood testing. You get a blood test from the anticubital fossa, the crook of your elbow, and if you're applying creams to the upper arm or the forearm, you're sort of, I wouldn't say contaminating, but you're increasing the concentration of that hormone in that localized area, and you get these really strange estradiol numbers when you do a blood test. So we're pretty adamant, you just inner thigh, you don't need to rotate too much. You could change legs if you want, maybe one in the morning on one leg and one in the evening on the other leg, but you don't have to always find a new location to apply the cream. Now she's applying 4 pumps in the morning, right? So we try to, as a way to allow them to apply less cream at each time, we would do 2 pumps in the morning and then 2 pumps in the evening.
And just raise the concentration.
And then over time, you just raise the dose. Now you can still apply more pumps as you're getting closer to that, which we sort of educate our patients to do when they're just getting started out, or they're going through either a hot flash issue, or in this case, a palpitation issue, is you can do, you start out with 2 and then go to 3, then go to 4. And you can do that, twice a day. Let's say your sleep is affected at night. You could apply more pumps at night to help with your sleep. And then that translates at the end of that prescription, when the patient is ready for a refill, the extra pumps or twists, like a Topiclic has a twist on the bottom, And those extra pumps or twists turns into a milligram amount, and now the concentration of the prescription can be increased. Okay, that is valuable information for the prescribers, for you and I. So now they get their symptoms solved in a relatively short amount of time. So I'm sure Amanda would love to have her palpitations go away. She's trying to exercise on a regular basis, and she's having all these palpitations. She doesn't want to be exercising while she's having palpitations. That's enough to kind of scare everyone, anyone. So that way she can kind of get to that magical dose, whatever dose works for her, sooner rather than later.
And sorry, not to be redundant, but I would like to circle back to about applying your hormone cream. Because I know there's a lot of information out there on the internet. Even pharmacists, you know, they're brilliant. They'll tell you, oh, you need to rotate the cream, put it on your stomach, put it on your arms, put it on your legs, put it on the back of your knee, put it on your bum. I hear that all the time. So I just want to say, I do like the inner thigh, because I do feel like when people put things on their stomach, the adipose or fat tissue on your stomach, it's a lot more volatile than, say, it's just a different, like, for example, just fat tissue itself, or an adipose cell, is its own endocrine gland. Like, our fat produces so many different hormones. So I do kind of feel like that putting hormones on your actual stomach is, I've just never liked it that way. And also because your skin, it's, you know, when you apply something to your skin, it can move around. So if you apply hormone cream to your stomach, it can matriculate and actually go up to the breast tissue. And breast tissue is very volatile. I don't like have any hormones on the breast tissue. So that's why I would advocate not to put hormone cream on your stomach, anywhere near your breasts. Even like Dr. Mackey was saying about the arms, putting hormone cream on your arms. Let's say, you know, right now I'm wearing a tank top. If I put it on my arms, or if I didn't have a shirt on, I could touch, you know, my arms could touch my breast tissue, and then that hormone cream gets on that breast tissue. So I'm kind of a stickler for that. Even for the bum, let's say you put your hormone cream on your bum and then you go and sit down on the toilet seat, then the next person that comes over to the toilet seat is going to, you know, you're going to be sharing that hormone cream with them. So,
like, now, but usually at the doses we're talking about here, so I'd love for Amanda to look at her dose and try to figure out, you know, if it's like 0.8 milligrams or 1 milligram, it ain't going to matter too much. But like you mentioned about men, when they're using hundreds of milligrams of testosterone, for kids, pets, and female spouses, that can be a really big deal. That can cause some problems, you know. So it's not so much the female to everyone else necessarily. Certainly, kids and pets don't need to have any hormone cream at all, right? That's going to cause some problems. Now, you brought up a kind of another thing there about not getting the, because men think if they're going to apply testosterone cream, right, to their inner thigh, we tell men to do exactly the same thing. I always make sure to tell them it's their first time not to put the cream on their testicles. Okay, do not put testosterone cream on your testicles. Keep them far, far away from your testicles, because they'll literally shrivel up like raisins, right? You cannot put it directly. So it's sort of it's not that would be potentially dangerous necessarily, right? Estrogen does not cause breast cancer. It does not cause breast cancer. Okay, breast cancer is an insulin problem. It's a very complicated thing we'll go into in other episodes. However, it is still a hormone sensitive tissue. So you don't want to put a hormone directly on a hormone sensitive tissue. So it's just more of a comfortability standpoint, is just to not get it close. Though the inner thigh, it's away from everything. For the most part, it's there's a good fat layer in your inner thigh. So it's just a good place for absorption to happen. I've heard some women say like the skin on your forearm is thin, so they think that the absorption is better on the forearm because there's less skin there. And I think that's not the wrong kind of rationale to put it there. It should be
putting it on the forearm. You're right, the absorption goes right in, but I do find that if you do put it on that type of skin, the absorption goes in, but then it comes out very quickly, as opposed to like the inner thigh that's got that fat pad there that it can, you know, enter through there and a little, you know, slowly be dispersed, as opposed to instantly being dispersed when you put it on that forearm.
Sure. Yeah. But you can't go wrong. I mean, inner thigh, pretty much the same spot every time. You could rotate a little bit, you know, inner thigh, top of the thigh, outer thigh, back of your thigh. Yeah. You could rotate a little bit, but you're not going
to
get,
you need to.
Yeah. You're not going to get any tissue fatigue.
I've never seen in 20 years, I've never seen tissue fatigue on the inner thigh.
No. Honestly, we've been doing this a long time.
Or adaptation. I've never seen it.
Yeah, very, very rarely. And that's also why when we make the prescription, we do two clicks or two pumps or two clicks twice a day. So that way you're applying less cream at each time. The less cream you apply, the less likely there is to have that tissue fatigue. Now, when we're doing rhythmic dosing with someone, you made a funny face, or what did I say that you didn't agree with?
You said there's less likely for tissue fatigue. I thought we just said there really isn't tissue fatigue if you put it on the MFI. Yeah,
okay, less likely and it's not going to happen. Okay, same thing.
Okay, I'm splitting hairs here.
Yeah, you're so literal all the time. You're totally right. I don't think that tissue fatigue is like a real thing. Like the absorbency, as you said earlier, is going to be maintained. By the time you get to your second dosage later that day or the next day, 24 hours later, it's fine. But that's also why we do two pumps twice a day. One, to spread out the dosing. So you're dosing it every 12 hours, morning, evening, morning, evening, as opposed to do it once every 24 hours. Almost like you're starting over every 24 hours.
I will say with men, they have a little bit thicker skin, that when I'm having them do the testosterone, some men, because of their skin, they're not absorbing it as well, as I'll have the pharmacies put in a little DMSO.
Yeah. And they are going to have more body hair too, right? Yeah, they're going to exactly. some men are, I'm sort of like follically challenged. I got plenty of hair on my head, thank God. but I don't have a lot of body hair. Mm-mm. My dad's the same way. My dad, I'm Finnish descent, and I can't grow a mustache. I can't grow a beard.
I have more body hair than you do.
yeah. Well, not really, but
I shave.
Yeah.
I shave my legs.
Yeah. But so for me, something like that's really easy, but some men are, very hairy. So for them, they might actually have to find a unique spot, behind the knee, is a spot where
I just have the pharmacy add some DMSO. Works
great. Well, but most people don't know what DMSO is. Most, even practitioners don't even know to do that. Don't go buy it on Amazon.
Okay. Oh, no.
Yeah,
no,
the pharmacy put it. Do not buy DMSO on Amazon, because literally DMSO is a sulfur-containing compound that helps things absorb across your skin. So it could be dangerous in some situations, like if you're working around a lot of chemicals or solvents. Mm. You don't want any DMSO around chemicals and solvents, because now all those chemicals and solvents get into your body. So I think I've seen a question on one of our comments on our website a while ago. Can I use DMSO from Amazon? I'm like, no, don't do that. Make sure that it's done by the compounding pharmacy, and you use it only with the hormone cream, not with everything else all the other chemicals we're around on a regular basis, because that could be sort of like a not such a great idea. But you're right, for men, women don't need the DMSO, right? That's not really necessary. For some men that are very, very hairy, the DMSO might be necessary. So again, there's still a lot to, unpack there, but hopefully just looking at our dosage, applying it twice a day, and then just kind of gradually working up that dosage over time. What I was going to ask you earlier, what do you think, just speculation, where do you think her dose range or her dose is right now? What would you say? Because we see a lot of questions like this.
Honestly, it's probably pretty low. It's probably like 1 milligram. Maybe.
It's probably more than likely under 2 milligrams. Yeah. Under 2 milligrams.
And hey, you got to start somewhere. It's better to start lower and work your way up than do too much of a good thing and you got to work your way back. So I understand that. I just think it's probably just a little bit too low for Amanda. And as she's able to get for her, because she's got the classic menopausal symptoms. I mean, all you women listening that are in menopause know this, the weight gain, the hot flashes, the you'd be surprised how many women will say, I've got like a little flip-flop in my chest. It feels like my heart's doing somersaults. It's so common to have that. So she's having a lot of a lot of those classic symptoms that I think it really probably just dials down to probably her estrogen dose, and then to go on a completely, let's go right down the rabbit's hole. The fact that she had a hysterectomy at 40 probably means she had fibroids, heavy bleeding, a thick, endometrial lining of her uterus, fibroids,
fibroids and bleeding.
And very commonly, women that have, heavy periods, they have fibroids, they tend to be more estrogen dominant. So she probably went from being sort of estrogen dominant to now no estrogen, that she's really noticing the symptoms. So she definitely probably needs to raise up that estrogen.
Yeah, her body is probably, and she's very fit too, right? So her body is probably accustomed to having a lot more there. That's the problem. And sometimes with static dosing, what she's doing right here is static dosing, same dose every day. It really comes down to how much you're using on a regular basis to be able to control those symptoms. It's not what you're using. It's the amount of it that you're using. Now, one thing, I would just go back to the palpitations. I'm sort of fascinated by some of the heart stuff just because my dad was a chronic cardiac patient. When I was in college and undergrad, I used to work at a hospital. And I was my official title was a cardiac monitor technician. So I used to sit in a room with a couple of coworkers, and we'd sit in front of a bunch of computer screens using telemetry and monitor people's heart rhythms. So I got really good at interpreting heart rhythms, PVCs, and we would track all that stuff, PVCs and PACs and AFib and third degree heart block and SVT and all these different things. It was fascinating. I got to learn a ton about arrhythmias. Now, I will say for some of them, some of the common ones, so PVCs, AFib, and SVT, there is not a lot of good treatments for those. The treatment options is usually beta blockers and some other things, and they just don't really work all that well. So that's why we've seen over the years all these menopausal women, when they're just going into menopause, they start having hot flashes and the palpitations. My point is she mentions one thing in parentheses in her question. She says, I started having PVC palpitations, in parentheses, she put, with no chest pain or dizziness. Why that's important is because when you're having arrhythmias, but you're not, as she said, chest pain, which would be angina. Nobody wants, heart issues with chest pain. That's an emergency room trip if you're having chest pain. That's why oftentimes women, men as well, if you're having chest pain, they're trying to differentiate between GERD, acid reflux, and chest pain, like real cardiac chest pain, because sometimes they can be confusing. So she says no chest pain, so we can assume no angina. The angina means you got to go get that evaluated immediately, and no dizziness, meaning that enough blood is, her heart's pumping well enough, so enough blood is getting to her head. Okay, they call that syncope in cardiology terms. If you feel faint because you're having an arrhythmia, that means your heart's not perfusing well enough, and you're gonna literally pass out, right? So she says no chest pain. I'm assuming her cardiologist told her that, no chest pain and dizziness. That minimizes the severity of the palpitations. If your faculties are intact, you can think, you can talk, you can pretty much carry on with the palpitations, then the palpitations, it lowers the severity of the palpitations, okay? So at that point, it's just sort of, and like I said, when I used to work at the hospital, saw lots of cardiologists come through, they'd track the rhythms. They didn't have, like I said, they didn't have good treatment options for their arrhythmias, but they weren't overly worried about them. They want to know if they're happening, but because the treatment options pharmaceutically weren't very good, they just sort of kind of blew them off. There are some things they are paying attention to. There's some types of arrhythmias that are very life-threatening, third degree heart block and different kinds of heart block. Those are some things we don't really have to worry about. Those are serious problems. That's sort of dangerous. So that's why women do have to go get evaluated by the cardiologist, make sure that nothing serious like that is going on. Most of the time it's not. Most of the time it's something sort of relatively benign. But I do think that even some of that fitness and what I was, talking about that with in that realm too, sort of contributes to some of those arrhythmias on an ongoing basis.
Because of the cortisol levels?
Yeah, I mean, that's where it's complicated, right? So when you're in medicine, everyone makes everything so reductionistic. Your lungs is your lungs, your heart, your brain, but as well as I do, the body doesn't really work that way. Other systems affect other systems all the time. And that's why I've always approached arrhythmias as being an adrenal issue, stress, or exercise, which is just self-induced stress, that very often can make the heart very sensitive. She mentions a Dutch test. On the Dutch test, it has cortisol and cortisone. Cortisone production for someone who's exercises is a metabolite of cortisol. Cortisone is very excitable to the cardiac tissue in a particular part of the heart. So if you're exercising a lot, you're burning through lots of cortisol, you're producing a lot of cortisone, that cortisone can excite those heart cells and then make it kind of volatile and you start having arrhythmias.
I think what she might be referring to a little bit is, hey, she's really fit. She eats really clean. She's 50 years old.
What the hell's happening?
She's female.
Yeah.
I mean, when you were, like you said, when you worked in the hospital 100 years ago.
That was a long time ago. Jesus. That was a long time ago.
And were there women that were very fit, ate very clean, and 50 years old
No.
that you were monitoring?
No. No. Yeah. That floor, this is, it's sort of, honestly, it's kind of turned me off a little bit because it was just a revolving door of the same people all the time. Band-aid, 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 send them home. They come back, send them home, come back, send them home, come back. It was, and also my dad, was going through sort of a similar situation at the same time. He had a heart attack, his second heart attack the year I graduated. So I was 18. He was, I don't even know what he was then, 50 something. Maybe, yeah, something like that. Maybe, no, maybe 60-something. He had his first heart attack when I was 45. When he was 45, I was like 5 years old. My dad was 41 when I was born, so I was like five or six. Second heart attack at 18, then he ended up having three more after that. So he sort of kind of went, passed away at the age of 67 from his fifth heart attack. So seeing that in my early 20s and then working at the hospital, which was a great job, I learned a tremendous amount about conventional cardiology, the good and the bad of conventional cardiology, and saw, you know, like I said, it was just more like what you're talking about, these really healthy women that we interact with. And I mean, honestly, Amanda is probably picture perfect health, right? I mean, just she's probably super fit. Her insulin sensitivity is great. She's metabolically healthy. You know, all that stuff, but she's, you know, her quality of life is being affected by the hot flashes, the little bit of weight gain,
menopause.
And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, menopause. Menopause is, you know, sort of being, I mean, now granted, she's doing a lot of things right. She's putting herself in the right situation, but you know, this is where the devil's in the details, right? The last little bit is, you know, I think is going to hopefully help her overcome these issues so she can still continue to live her healthy lifestyle and not be encumbered by these distractions, so to speak, right? So yeah, good for Amanda.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. So anything else to split apart there? I think we sort of answered all her questions kind of in in a roundabout sort of way. But this is a very common situation for lots of women. Terrifying, right? When those palpitation things show up. So I know that it should provide a little kind of like a sigh of relief for the women listening that the palpitations don't mean that your heart is there's anything wrong with your heart. This is, you know, again, kind of a different system affecting your heart, but you still need to have it evaluated. So if you're having those issues, go get it checked out like Amanda did, just to make sure that everything is, you've had it signed off and ruled out by your cardiologist.
Absolutely. I agree. Like I was saying, Amanda's question does pertain to so many other women out there that are going through menopause.
Yeah. So if you're interested in having your question read on the podcast, go to our website, progresshealth.com, ask the doctor tab, put in your name and email. We are also launching a community later 2024. We have a tentative kind of launch date, but we're not going to release that yet. To expand, we've gotten a lot of feedback about the podcast, very positive. Women want more answers to these things. So we're expanding on that idea and creating a community where we all can kind of further the conversation about these things and really leverage our knowledge and experience with all of you. So if you're interested, you can go on the website and you'll see a tab there'll be a couple of buttons on the homepage. It'll say join waitlist. If you click the button, it'll bring it to a little opt-in page, put in your name and email. We're just basically trying to get an understanding of who's interested in our community. We think that there's hopefully lots of interest because, you know, we think that there's a nice conversation happening here. So if you're interested in something like that, click join waitlist. It'll put your name on the waiting list, and we'll be able to communicate more through that waitlist as we have more details and we get closer to the launch date of that community.
And definitely, thank you, Amanda. Thank you, everybody, for writing in and asking your questions. I know we have quite a bit of them, so that's why I think there's going to be a really good interest in our community. But if you haven't heard your question, we're going to try to get to them all, but We're doing our best.
Yeah. So anything else to add? Are we?
No, this was great. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm hoping that we answered Amanda's question and everyone else that's listening. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.